It was a lot.
Welcome to Eye to the Sky, the UFO Synopsis. Now, here's your host, DeAndrew.
And welcome to Eye to the Sky, the UFO Synopsis, here on the UFO Paranormal Radio Network, also broadcast live on UPRN 105.5 New Orleans. I'm your host, DeAndrew, and tonight my guest is Peter Robbins. I need to remind everyone that you can listen to the UFO Paranormal Radio Network on your cell phone simply by calling 704-631-4060 and entering the four-digit station ID code 2899. My guest tonight, Peter Robbins, has been involved in UFO studies for more than 30 years as a researcher, investigator, writer, lecturer, activist, and author. He is co-author of the British bestseller, Left at Eastgate, a first-hand account of the Rendlesham Forest UFO incident, its cover-up and investigation. Mr. Robbins has lectured extensively in the States and abroad on topics including, but not limited to, the Rendlesham Forest incident, suppression of UFO information by the American and British governments, James Forrestal, First Secretary of Defense, and early casualty of UFO secrecy, declassified UFO-related documents, Dr. Willem Reich and UFOs and the UFO abduction phenomenon, UFOs and aliens in advertising, the media, and UFOs, stress, and UFO studies. Peter Robbins has been on Eye to the Sky several times, and he is always one of my favorite researchers to have on the program as my guest. It is my great pleasure for me to be able to welcome him back as my guest tonight. And welcome back, Peter.
Hi, Dee. Good to be back on the show.
Oh, my goodness. Could you tone down just a little bit? Your volume is pretty loud.
Should I speak lower? How's this?
It's still a little bit loud. I'm told that it's distorting.
I can speak softer if you like.
That's perfect. Thank you. Hey. Appreciate it. Oh, gosh. Hey, from what I understand, you had a very short notice here recently come up with a lecture for the X conference.
I did. I had 5 days, which is not the kind of lead time I prefer for an hour and 15-minute talk at the National Press Club. But I was really delighted to be invited, and I stayed in my hotel room and worked on it diligently until 1 the morning before, and went on at 9 Sunday morning, and I think it was well received.
Can you give us a little hint what you talked about?
Of course. Well, I talked about the UFO ridicule factor, which we've, of course, discussed on the show, and how it came to be. I think many people, even colleagues in the field, feel that it grew gradually in the media, maybe because hoaxes were uncovered and the media got a little gun-shy. But in fact, it hit the floor running in early July of 1947, and the charge was led by the venerable New York Times, which from the get-go, from their very first article, treated the subject with contempt, sarcasm, condescension, and ridicule. And what I did for the talk was I showed many dozens of early articles and read some of the salient facts lines from the articles, and on the same timeline showed many different declassified American government intelligence and military documents, which, of course, take a 180-degree different view than the silliness in the media. And we went on to basically discuss how this might have happened. The basis of the talk was ridicule and the fact that the facts said that this was a very serious phenomena and nothing to be ridiculed. And in fact, with noteworthy exceptions, we're still dealing with the same dynamic, aren't we?
This is true. We've been fighting the giggle factor for many, many years.
Mm. started in that summer. In fact, the Times did not even deem it worthy to cover the Roswell crash, but instead picked up their coverage 2 days later with the balloon reflector story and tore it apart and came back and attacked Roswell a number of times over that summer.
Oh, wow. I would have loved to have heard that lecture. That would have been a really good one to listen to.
I can arrange to send you a copy of the DVD. You watch it with David and send it back whenever you're done.
Oh, Peter, you're such a cool guy. You know that?
Thank you. Hey, for the cost of a postage stamp, I can be a sport.
Oh, well, hey, in my book, you've got the biggest part in ufology.
Thanks, sweetie.
you've been a pretty busy guy, you know, this last few months. Gosh, in March, you spoke at the Niagara Community College as a guest lecturer for an anthropology class.
I did, which was really so satisfying. I did two talks at this wonderful community college near Buffalo, New York, one for the general public and anybody at the school, and the next day for this particular class. I gave my sponsoring professors a choice of about a dozen topics, and they felt that the Rendlesham topic was the one to focus in on. Interestingly, a week before that, I spoke for a science class at Cornell University here in Ithaca, New York, and once again, given a number of topics, the students and the professor wanted to hear about Rendlesham. For the lecture, they expected about 70 to 100 people, and over 250 showed up. And boy, they had good questions.
Gosh, I can imagine, especially from a class of anthropology students.
Yeah. In fact, I talked a bit about ridicule in the media, and when the class was over, I took a number of questions, and it was about 70 students in a lecture theater. And as they were leaving, one particularly earnest, I learned later, a sophomore journalism major came up to me, and he was very serious. And he said, I really took it to heart what you said about the way that the media has treated this subject, and on behalf of print journalism, I just wanted to apologize. And I burst into laughter and told him he really didn't have to. I didn't consider him part of the problem at all.
Oh, well, that was nice of you. But it was interesting that this guy would come up and apologize for a profession he's going into.
Yeah, I thought it was, proactive kind of move. But, you know, with both the Cornell class and the Niagara County Community College class, it was just a reminder to me of what a vacuum informationally there is in our colleges and universities on any serious reference whatsoever to this subject. Both classes were very hungry for real documented information, and again, the Rendlesham case, as you know better than most people, has something of almost every aspect of what we look for in UFO cases, and both lectures were very dense with images, photographs, maps, drawings, etc. And the narrative, of course, sounds like fiction, but of course it's as well documented as any case in the annals of ufology. But it was a reminder to me that it's an optimistic thing that there are many, many students out there, university and colleges all over the country, and I'm sure all over the world, that would love to learn more about this but don't have an opportunity to.
Well, and then you spoke at the Western New York State MUFON meeting at the Swain Public Library in Albion, New York. That was just a couple of weeks ago.
Indeed. That was, in fact, the Thursday, May 6th, before the X conference at the National Press Club, where I spoke May 9th. And it was doubly cool because as I finished the talk, my good friend and colleague Rich Dolan, who lives about half an hour away in Rochester, came in, spent some time with us, and then I went back to his place And the next morning, he and his wonderful wife, Karen, and I rented a car and drove down to Washington together. And, boy, they're wonderful people to take a long drive with. There were no dull moments in our ride there or back.
Oh, that sounds like a lot of fun. I would have loved to have been in that car because, man, it would have been, nothing but UFO talk all the way there and all the way back.
And for what it's worth, I received my new copy of UFO Magazine this morning and was very pleased to see a great smiling picture of Rich on the cover and a huge feature article devoted to his important work that he's done over the past years. And it's so nice to see him singled out and acknowledged like that. He really is such a valuable person in the field. And I think that you have read the second part of UFOs in the National Security State, a very important book and one that everybody should have in their library.
Oh, I agree. I thoroughly agree with that, 100%. In fact, in an article I've got posted on my website here, in the last week or so, I even say in that article that I think Rich Dolan's book should be used, the whole series when he finally gets Volume 3 done, that all three of them should be considered as textbooks for a college-level course if they should ever happen to...
That's a great idea, Dee, and you know he is hard at work already on Volume number 3 in doing the research for number 2. He ended up doing quite a bit of the research for number 3, and it will simply pick up where number 2 leaves off, which is 1991. But he really is one of our best contributors right now, and again, so nice to see him acknowledged for this in the new issue of UFO Mag.
Oh, another thing I wanted to ask you about is when is this Bentwaters Rendlesham Roundtable going to be held and where?
Well, as you know, we had an initial radio show that went extremely well, and it was the first time a number of these witnesses had actually spoken with each other. The second installment, which will also be 3 full hours, and will feature Larry Warren, John Burroughs, and Jim Peniston, and that will be another first. These three men have not spoken together, possibly ever, but certainly not since 1980, and they all were witnesses to similar and different aspects of the events. It's going to be on Sunday, June 20th, and Eastern Standard Time from 7 to 10 p.m., as we get a bit closer to the show, what I'll do is forward you all of the particulars so that your listeners can listen with us. And I understand that what's going to happen after that show in June is that the last Sunday of every month for 2 hours, we will continue with a different mix of witnesses and researchers right up until the end of December, which, of course, is the actual 30th anniversary of the incident.
I have been told that you're getting just a little bit loud again and starting to distort.
Okay.
and speaking of Larry, David was chatting with Larry Warren through Facebook here just before the show, and he had given a lecture at the Lapis conference today in Lancashire.
Yes.
He said the talk went very well, and he said he was able to clear up some BS, quote-unquote.
Oh, great. Well, Larry is a master at clearing that stuff up. He is one of the most blunt presenters that we have, God knows. I have not spoken to him this evening, so I don't know how it went, but I'm glad Dave has some early news from the conference, and nothing could surprise me less.
You know, I had to really applaud Larry in that three-hour program. In fact,
yeah.
I've got a link saved to that so I can go through it and listen to it again.
Yeah.
And for the life of me, I am so horrible with names. But I was impressed with the gentleman that had called in during that particular program, who said that he was the guy on the main watch that night?
Yes, that was Tim.
Area?
That was Tim Agarik, who I first started to correspond with about 1998-1999. And Tim will be back as kind of a phone-in guest. And he contacted me after the show and said, "Oh my God, I hope I didn't come off too negative." I said, "Absolutely not. You know, this is an extraordinarily complex story. Everybody was having their own point of view on it or their own actual physical view on it. It was a series of events spanning two or three nights. And the bottom line is, every one of your points of view is valuable." So I was very pleased that he called in as well. And I'm hoping that Charles Halt, the deputy base commander, will also be back on this show, as also that we will have other witnesses calling in and added to the mix as we move forward on this monthly series on the last Sunday of each month.
Oh, gosh, I'm looking forward to that one as well.
Mm-hmm.
I think Rendlesham is a very pivotal incident. I mean, holy cow, look at all the military people that were involved in this incident.
Yeah.
And it being an American Air Force bunch on British soil is even, you know, more compelling.
I couldn't agree with you more, Dee. I think American ufology has a particular blind spot, and maybe every country has it, namely, if it didn't happen here, how important can it be? It's taken quite a number of years for it to sink in for Americans who study this, that although it happened on foreign soil, literally all of the key eyewitnesses and people involved were American service personnel. Now, that does not in any way suggest that there were not local English residents as well who witnessed aspects of this. There were. And their accounts matter as well, and we have a number of them in Left at East Gate. But yes, it is, for me, kind of a Rosetta Stone, let's face it, as important and significant as the events of the summer of 1947 were in New Mexico. All but a tiny handful of the individuals involved are gone now. The paper trail, although it's been very lush with documents, I don't know if we'll ever see anything new or what it will take to, you know, get more information. But Rendlesham has literally everything and dozens of witnesses that if Congress ever had the courage again to get involved in this subject and look into it in committee, this is one that these witnesses could be subpoenaed for and, you know, could be compelled to testify.
You know, and it's not just the Rendlesham Forest incident that happened from the same area. From what I understand, Milton Torres, when he was ordered to fire a missile at a huge object, wasn't he out of, I don't remember whether it was Bentwaters or Woodbridge, but from one of those two bases?
You know, he might have been at Lincoln Heath, or one of the other bases nearby, especially during the Cold War. The concentration of NATO and RAF and American leased bases in that part of England was without comparison. It's escaping me right now which base exactly Torres took off from and landed from that he was assigned to at the time, but it was in that area, yeah.
Yes, and I've read of several incidences that happened there around those two bases.
Absolutely.
Had people dispatched.
Yeah, and there's
bases.
A very famous case in 1956. In fact, we include a good part of a National Security Agency report in the index and Left at East Gate that documents craft that were seen on radar, observed from the ground, observed by pilots in the air, moving, I believe, at something like 7,000 miles an hour between Bentwaters and I think Lincoln Heath, and they were able to confirm the extraordinary speed of these things, and this is in 1956. This is an area of England also, for what it's worth, with a particularly high concentration of UFO sightings and events over the decades. As we know, you know, there are areas all over the world that have higher incidence of sightings, and we can make our best educated guesses as to why. More esoteric people talk about portals and, you know, dimensional entrances. It may just be some statistical thing that is not necessarily referential to some stunning fact, but it may. The fact that it is such a huge concentration of military enclaves would be something that might well interest other intelligences that are keeping an eye on us.
Okay, and David, thank you. He gave me the information on Milton Torres.
Mm.
At the time, he was a 25-year-old lieutenant with the 514th Fighter Interceptor Squadron in the 406th Air Expeditionary Wing based out of RAF Manston in Kent.
Oh, okay. That's not far away. Very good. Thank you, David.
He says you're welcome. Also, I've noticed that John Burroughs has a Facebook group called Justice for the Bentwaters 81st Security Police at Rendlesham Forest 1980, and it's grown to over 1,300 members.
Yes.
And it's growing steady. And
yes.
Also, the music that Larry posted on
yeah.
Facebook from that I thought was awesome.
Yes. Larry, of course, has many contacts in the world of popular music, and I'm always proud that one of the people who helped us tremendously complete the book, quite literally, by giving us materials worth thousands of dollars to sell and head back to England, was the late, wonderful Stevie Ray Vaughan, who was very supportive of our work and a good friend of Larry's. But for your listeners, if you are on Facebook, do visit Justice for the 81st Facebook page, and don't think because you weren't there or you weren't in the Air Force or you're not directly involved in this, you can join and be involved in discussion groups online or just keep your sort of hands on the pulse of what's going on. It is so far the most successful effort to bring together actual individuals who were involved and do it in a way where they are safe to discuss the situation, you know, without revealing all kinds of information about themselves if they choose not to. I'm a member of it, have not posted nearly as much as I would like to. It's just been a very busy couple of months, but John Burroughs has done a terrific job in getting this together. And John has been really one of the most out there witnesses we have had since Larry first came forward. And he continues to work with Linda Moulton Howe, and they did a terrific presentation on some of John's memories, experiences, and more poignantly, the memories that he is trying to get to in therapy and regressive hypnosis that I think are probably quite terrifying for him.
Oh gosh, I can't imagine what these guys have gone through for the last almost 30 years.
Yeah, I think that's the right phrase to use. I'm about as involved as anyone can be who was not there. I've been back to those locations more times than I can remember on probably something like 20 separate visits to England since 1988. And you know what? I can't imagine either what it was really like to have been involved. And not just involved, but unlike, say, a civilian event where, you know, you have an experience or a contact or an abduction experience, for those of us without military backgrounds, I don't think we can really conceive of the pressure that is put on individuals like this to keep the hell quiet. And the extra compression that causes, you know, in your life, in your psyche, and how that can blow back on you later in life.
Oh, well, didn't Charles Halt get some flack when his memo wound up in the public realm?
Well, he sure did, and he told Larry and I in person years ago, and he said it in public venues and on broadcasts a number of times, that when he was informed by the Air Force that this Freedom of Information action had come in and that they were going to be releasing his one-page report on it, did he have any comment? He said, yeah, burn it. There is no question that Mr. Holt, who continues to be one of the most complex and fascinating players in this, he was, after all, deputy base commander. He is an honorably retired Air Force officer with more than 20 years service, but he is on a certain level for me, has run a certain amount of interference. At the same time, he is now more forthcoming than he has ever been. And to hear a retired American Air Force colonel say what my men and I saw that night was not built by any government on this planet is compelling. It's another reason why I hope he'll continue to be part of this roundtable series of broadcasts. But yes, he is very much an interesting player in this whole story.
Oh, and then the description that Peniston, the recorded description that Linda Howe had at
yes.
crash conference this last November of him describing the object that he, you know, basically was sitting right in front of him. He walked all the way around it, touched it, felt it, took copious notes
yes.
on description, and him talking about seeing like, well, the easiest way I can think of to describe it, lighted shapes underneath or in the surface of this thing moving.
Yeah. It kind of blows your mind, especially when you hear these guys talk about this in a conversational first-person way or in any of the handful of quality documentaries that they've done. Jim and John both have periods of time on that first night being out in the Rendlesham Forest that are not accounted for. They both have somewhat different memories of some of the same moments. And I think it's very important to remember in that no matter what tremendous powers these other intelligences have to affect our thinking, that good old physiological shock all by itself is pretty impressive. And if you have ever had the experience, or any of your listeners who have had the experience of being a witness to, say, an auto accident, you know, even a fender bender, the moment you hear that metal smash metal, you know, there is an adrenaline dump, an epinephrine dump into your body. You go through a certain amount of tunnel vision. You may go through auditory exclusion. It may be very difficult to sleep for some time. And if there are six witnesses, their memories will all be somewhat different, even though they observe the same thing and sometimes from the same angle. So the discrepancies in some of these firsthand accounts is more than understandable, especially given this almost 30 years since it's happened. Add to that the pressure put upon them by the military, by society, if you will, in some cases by these individuals' religious communities, if they're people of faith.
Family members?
Exactly.
Friends?
Yeah, there are a number of witnesses, one in particular who comes to mind who is very much involved, at least on the first and second night, who I know for a fact his family prevailed upon him to please not get involved in this from the get-go. And part of that was because they're fairly religious, and the implications to some family members suggested a conflict in their beliefs and what may or may not have happened here. And in fact, he has kept out of the light, although anybody familiar with the case knows his name. And I am not one of those researchers or investigators that puts the case first. It's wonderful to be able to have everything go your way in an investigation, and everybody that was involved or observed to just lay it out for you and allow you to use their names and quote them and all this stuff. But for many of these people, this is one of the, or if not the most traumatic or upsetting or paradigm-challenging events of their life. And I've had many frustrating experiences where I have implored people to please, you know, allow me to use their account under a pseudonym with their identity absolutely disguised in every way possible. And when they say no that final time, basically, if you care about people, you have to respect it. I even have had moments in my work where I wish I was a little less ethical and just said, ah, screw it. You know, I'll just lay it out there because it's more important that the world know about this event than that somebody's a little embarrassed. I think when you cross that line, you have no business to be working in the field. Again, I put people first, and one can argue that the subject is just too important, but for me, never more important than the lives of individuals who have been touched by it.
Well, just having a spectacular sighting can change a person's whole outlook.
Absolutely, absolutely.
Now, my daughter had a sighting here, oh gosh, I believe it was a week ago, Wednesday night or Thursday night, one of the two.
Mm-hmm.
And she was all excited. She goes, Mom, 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 I got you. I mean, she wasn't even home yet from work.
Oh,
she was
man.
On her way home when it happened. And she was just talking so fast, I had to tell her to slow down.
This
so
was
I
the first for her, D?
Actually, no, it was her second. And they've all been in this little town in Idaho called Emmett. And I had three sightings in that town myself. I lived there for many, many years. And all my sightings there have been right from my own yard.
Oh, my gosh. Can you share with us what your daughter saw?
Okay, she was coming home from work. She works a swing shift. Mm-hmm. And she works in Boise, which is about a 30-mile drive, roughly.
Oh.
And was coming home, and it was dark. And there was another car in front of her. She was just coming into town. And the car in front of her all of a sudden slowed down real fast. And she's going, you know, slowed down real fast herself to keep from rear-ending the car in front of her. I was going, well, what is this idiot slowing down for? And, you know, could see the driver of the other car, you know, the silhouette through her headlights.
Yeah.
Look to the right. And goes, well, what are they looking at? Why are they paying attention to the road?
You know, sure.
She looks to see what they were looking at. And she said, here was this big, huge, bright blue light.
Whoa.
Coming from the west, went between, there's a mountain to the north of Emmett called Squaw Butte. There's the summit of the butte, and then the foot of the butte. It kind of slopes down off the summit and then comes back up a little bit for the foot. And she said it went between the summit and the foot. And she said it was going so fast. She says, Mom, it had to have crashed. She said there's no way that thing could have stopped in time to keep from hitting the ground. But she said, and, you know, she said, I braced myself. I just knew there was going to be an explosion.
And, of course, there wasn't.
And there was nothing.
And
she said it was flying at a relatively low level.
Damn.
And she just couldn't wait to get on the phone and call me. You know?
Well,
and,
with a mother like David, you, what a...
and,
wow.
And as David has posted in our virtual auditorium here, he said, Dee's daughter is always teasing us about our interest in UFOs and our UFO and abductee friends.
All the better.
You know, so that when he says he's going to tease her for having a second sighting, automatically makes her an honorary member of the Tinfoil Hat Society.
Yeah, total weirdo. I wouldn't even feel comfortable with her in an elevator. Uh-uh.
Oh, well, she's just like her mom. So,
yeah. By the way, what time was this roughly?
Let's see, she's in mountain time, so I would say somewhere between, I'm guessing 10:30, 11 o'clock at night.
Oh, great. So it was, she saw the light against a night sky.
Yes.
Cool.
And the summit of the butte has a fire lookout tower and a bunch of relay stations.
Uh-huh, sure.
Up there, you know, telephone, TV, radio.
Yeah, I have a little familiarity with that part of Idaho, and what a beautiful state you come from.
Oh, well, it's beautiful, yes, but not to live there.
Well, Boise is a pretty hip town. Here I am, a New Yorker. I lived most of my life in Manhattan, and first trip to Boise, I thought, oh, boy, this is going to be just some kind of burg. But I was actually quite humbled. It's got great architecture and wonderful, interesting districts and shops and beautifully laid out city. I'm sure it's changed a lot in the last couple of decades and grown quite a bit, as I understand it. But I really enjoyed my visit there and to other parts of Idaho as well. But, yeah, understood.
Oh, there's a lot of sightings in that area that go unreported.
Mm.
One thing I want to get to here,
yeah,
too, is you've got an upcoming series of talks, I believe, there in New York City.
I do.
On June 12th and 13th for the Association for Research and Enlightenment, which I've been to their headquarters in Virginia Beach.
That is a place I've never visited and very much want to. I have to say I consider myself an extreme skeptic on the channeling phenomena. Let's face it, it's one of the easiest things in the world to fake.
I agree.
But Edgar Cayce is in a class by himself, and the records of his thousands of sessions with people around the world were scrupulously kept. Those entries are part of the legacy and the archive of ARE, and I must say, I do accept his work overwhelmingly, and I was taken aback a bit because ARE, there is some interest in UFOs, of course, but it's hardly their meat and potatoes, and they do have a very active chapter in New York City. In fact, the Intruders Foundation that Bud Hopkins founded, that I've worked with for years as well, when we have an event or a seminar in New York, we have always leased their auditorium, their small speaking space, for our events. So I'm familiar with the space, but was very honored to be invited by them, and I'll be speaking for them on Saturday the 12th, as you've said. And it will be on a number of aspects of UFO studies, but primarily my very non-mystical look at UFOs from a religious point of view. And it's not going to be filled with goodness and light. I'm going to talk about actually going back to the mists of time and things that more simple civilizations were not able to explain. And so human nature is we mystify what we don't understand very often, when it may be something that is more properly in the category of science and or physics or history or something. But I expect it will be a very engaging audience. And the next day, I'm speaking for a very different group called Disclosure Network New York, which is they use the term disclosure, but they're completely independent, as I understand it. And that will be a three-hour kind of informal roundtable talk and discussion about the state of ufology today. We'll be reviewing some of the stuff that I talked about at the National Press Club. And an always interesting audience with sensational questions. And for me, even though New York is my home, I don't get to speak there that often. So to have two completely different talks to do in the same weekend is very exciting. And I'll go down a bit early and stay a bit late and see friends and hopefully have a bunch of them come to the different talks. Yeah, that's coming up very soon.
Wish I could go there.
Me too.
I've never been to New York City.
Ooh, well, someday you and David will come. And I'm sure I've told you over the years that besides being a good amateur historian of the city, I made part of my living when I was struggling as a writer as a walking tour guide, not one of those bus guys that talks into a mic, but basically somebody that would sit down with out-of-towners and design a walking tour of the city based on whatever their interests were. And I still enjoy doing it tremendously. I got a job actually next weekend with some friends who are coming in from England. And I am available, ladies and gentlemen. You can contact D'Andrew and arrange to contact me through her. And yes, if I'm well paid, I'll get a piece of the action.
Hey, we have a question from our virtual auditorium concerning the recent X conference. This is from Taldorf, and he would like to know how was the turnout for the X conference.
My estimate was about 200 or so folks that were there in the audience, and they were from all over the place. I'm sure at least half the states were represented, but I understand also that there were several hundred other people that were with us straight through the weekend, having subscribed to a live feed that Steve Bassett had set up, so that if you were in another part of the country or another part of the world, you could still be at the conference, so to say, straight through from Friday night until Sunday night. And it was a very good audience as well. A number of familiar faces for me and a whole bunch of new faces for me. I'm trying to remember what the event was, whether it had to do with the Supreme Court. I don't think it coincided with the terrible spill in the Gulf, but there was something going on in Washington I know that was drawing a tremendous amount of news coverage. So not that they need an excuse, the attendance of legitimate news people at the X conferences. It should always be more. Steve works so hard to bring these events to the Beltway area. And once again, the ridicule factor is very active. And I'm sure that journalists, even if they have a private interest in the subject, the thought that they have to cover this and maybe even worse, write some serious story about it. We are still living in the 1940s in terms of the way this whole subject is digested and spit out by the media. So the actual attendance of broadcast and print journalists was much less than any of us would have wanted to see. At the same time, the conference was extremely well organized. And let me tell you, having spoken at an awfully large number of UFO conferences here and abroad, there was something automatically elevating about getting up to that podium and knowing that it said National Press Club rather than the Marriott or the such-and-such UFO conference. Again, it's psychological, but to know people who, you know, world figures who had come into that hall and spoken on some of the most important topics of our time, I think was very good energy for all of us. And again, it was very, very well done. Our keynote speaker for the Sunday luncheon was George Norrie, who it's always fun to hear speak. He is such an interesting guy and such a decent guy who got into this work, you know, with a childhood interest on the subject, but is one of those people who loves the job that he does and, of course, has many, many fans among your listeners and many of our friends. But yeah, that's the long answer to your listener's question. I think there were about 200 people in the hall. And given the state of the economy, I was pleased. We were all concerned that there wouldn't even be that many.
I'm pleased to hear that there was that many. Gosh, I wish there could have been more.
Mm-hmm.
You know, the more people attend functions like this, the more information gets disseminated out to the public.
Completely.
You know, and the more that happens, the less giggle factor.
Well, I think also, I spoke at the first one, and I have not been back since. There's always been a conflict or something in our schedules. But I'll tell you what, I thought the speaker's lineup was extremely good. And again, Steve did a great job of putting it all together in a way that made it particularly professional. And it began with a great cocktail party on Friday night. And at that event, we were shown an almost complete print of a new documentary called The Day Before Disclosure, which Terry Tuffney's put together. Terry and his partner, Sigrid, no, not Sigrid, another wonderful Scandinavian name, I'll think of it. But he is a very respected Norwegian documentary filmmaker, and it's going to be shown on Norwegian and other Scandinavian television networks, but it will be available at some point here. But it was a great way to start off the weekend. The speakers, by the way, were Rich Dolan, A.J. Javard, I guess he's Brazil's best-known UFO researcher and a major publisher and conference organizer there in his own right. George Haas and Bill Sanders spoke on Sidonia, and it's nice to see that back. Paul Stonehill, who is probably one of our ranking scholars on Russian UFO events, pre- and post-communist, also spoke. I spoke, of course, one of my favorite journalists, George Knapp, spoke. Linda Howe, again, did a great presentation, bringing John Burroughs in, and then the two of them continued together. And Gary Hasseltine. Gary is a very interesting speaker. He's came over from Britain, and what sort of sets him apart is he is a serving police constable. He is a police officer in England. And before that, he was a military police officer. And he has kind of appropriately insinuated himself amongst the Rendlesham witnesses who respect him and understand that they have kind of a comrade in arms here. He is very logical, very thoughtful, and he has been working with Charles Halt on a screenplay of Mr. Halt's point of view and memories of the Rendlesham experience. We had quite a bit of time to chat, and I've known who he is for many years, but it was wonderful to finally meet him. And again, all in all, it was a very well-rounded conference, and there wasn't a single speaker who I would identify as extreme or, you know, a real tangent of the exopolitical or disclosure movement. I thought it was a sensational lineup with a great deal of serious conversation and lecture material. I wasn't able to see any the first day because I was working on my own in my hotel room, but the ones I saw the second day, the level of presentations was extremely high, and the AV setup in there was just as good as anywhere I've ever seen in my life.
Oh, well, it's the National Press Club. I
think, one would expect
they've
that,
you probably
bet.
Got some of the best equipment out there. Oh, gosh. Of the speakers that you saw, what was your favorite one?
I think Linda and John Burroughs, and I realize I'm biased. I'm more involved in the case material that wraps itself around what they're working on than any UFO incident in more than 30 years in the field. So maybe it's not fair and less than objective. But it was also the most human and the most emotional. Again, John is a big guy. I guess he's got to be 6'5 or 6'6. And
he's taller than I am, that's for sure.
Yeah, and being somewhat slightly below average stature myself, the first time I met John last November at the Crash Retrieval Conference, he gave me a hug and I thought I was going to disappear. I mean, he's a big guy, but he is in pain. He really is hurting, and he's got the courage to not get all macho about it and put it up front. And we saw clips of some of the hypnotic regressions he's done, including a very early one, and he was completely in another place. But there's a tremendous amount of anxiety that comes up that he is either blocking or just not quite ready to face. and he is the first to admit it. And Linda, of course, is, you know, such a crack in the culture. To hear her background material and then hear John talk, it was a real experience. Also, like Rich Dolan, who I'm not just a good friend of and colleague of, I just think he is one of the nicest people in the field, and he is also such a master of PowerPoint. Like Linda, I think the two of them, their visual presentations are among the best I have ever seen at any kind of conference on any subject. They really know how to work PowerPoint. I'm still pretty Stone Age about it, and I will show pictures, and then we'll go to the next picture, where theirs are like multimedia things, and they're just amazing to watch. And it's not like they're done in a show-off-y kind of way. They simply serve the material that they're talking about. I saw the first half of Rich's talk, and I thought it was superb, and actually was delighted this morning to when I went out to our mailbox to get the mail. I got my new issue of UFO Magazine, and there was Rich Dolan smiling at me from the cover. And a very major feature on his work, and boy, has he earned it.
I'm going to have to go out and get me a copy of that.
I think so.
And it's almost time for us to go to break. But
okay.
Before we do, I kind of want to mention, too, that starting on Monday, on the Rachel Maddow show on MSNBC, she's doing her... she has every now and then she'll have her segment that she calls a moment of geek. And this week is going to be a geek week.
Wow.
And one of their segments is going to deal with UFOs.
No kidding.
Now, exactly what day, the schedule hasn't come up. I haven't seen it anywhere. But, I'm kind of leery of how she's going to, portray this, whether with the giggle factor.
Let's keep our fingers crossed on that, because whether one agrees or disagrees with her politics, this is a smart woman and very well spoken. I could see her going either way on it, and I think for those of us that do take the subject seriously, it might not be a bad idea to try to tune that show in. And if she dishes on it and treats it in a silly, condescending way, to let her know how we feel about it. And if she has...
David and I made sure she was aware of the Cutler Twining memo.
Oh, cool.
emailed it to her.
Hey.
And on that note, we need to go to a break.
Okay.
So we'll be back in 8 or 9 minutes here with the Eye to the Sky, the UFO Synopsis on the UFO Paranormal Radio Network, and we'll be back soon.
Welcome to Eye to the Sky, the UFO Synopsis. Now here's your host, DeAndrew.
And welcome back to Eye to the Sky, the UFO Synopsis, here on the UFO Paranormal Radio Network, also broadcast live on UPRN 105.5 New Orleans. I'm your host, DeAndrew, and tonight we've been talking with Peter Robbins. Peter, I've been saving this next batch of stuff to talk about because it's, well, rather near and dear to me, and that's the upcoming Roswell Conference. There's an impressive speakers list.
Yes, there is. And you've caught me wonderfully off guard. I'm going to open my file here so I can speak with confidence and intelligence about our wonderful speakers lineup. I will say that for anybody that can join us at the UFO Festival and Symposium, it runs for 4 solid days from Thursday the 1st of July through Sunday the 4th of July, and the UFO Symposium will be on that Friday and Saturday. And I guess the first thing about it that folks should know is that if they can get themselves to Roswell, our symposium is entirely free. the city of Roswell is picking up the tab on this, and I am just delighted because, Lord knows, we're all watching our budgets, and this is a way that anybody can come in and just hear this great lineup of speakers for two full days. Also, I have the honor to be one of the co-organizers of the symposium, and it is completely Roswell-centric. We have a cross-section of some of the best and some of the best-known speakers, but all of them will be speaking about Roswell from the area of their specialties, including a number of local Roswell scholars better known in the Southwest and New Mexico than maybe they might be internationally, but for those of us in the field, they're all worthy of respect. We'll be starting out with Guy Malone, who is a Roswell resident and longtime student of the subject, and he will be the one who will be putting forward an alternate theory. His title of his talk is When the Mythology is Stripped Away, What Facts Remain? And he, I have to say, I don't know whether this is his absolute belief or whether he's taken it on as kind of an intellectual exercise, but he's putting forward that the crash of a UFO, an unidentified flying object, may have been the government's cover story that they then feigned protest over to cover some top secret experiment. That is certainly not my point of view, but we've tried to include every point of view imaginable. Dennis Balthaser, who is quite a well-known writer on the subject of UFOs and has worked for numerous websites and has a regular column, as I recall, in UFO Magazine, and is also a Roswell resident. He's going to be talking about the events from the point of view of how they were perceived originally and how they're perceived now. From there, we go to Ken Storch, who is a law enforcement officer for 25 years now, and he'll be talking about Roswell investigated as though it were a law enforcement subject. I think that's not a bad model, actually, for investigators to look into UFO events the way that police officers look into crimes. Not that UFO events are crimes, but the model for investigating is a very solid one. Donald Burleson, who is a PhD and author of, I think, 15 books now. Don is also a local Roswell resident, and he's also state director of MUFON for New Mexico. He's going to focus in specifically on scientific considerations relative to the event. This one is particularly close to my heart. Some of your listeners who were in McMinnville last weekend or at the Ozarks Conference this spring or heard James Clarkson first speak on this subject at last November's Crash Retrieval Conference will know what I'm talking about when I say this is a very special presentation. James is talking about a woman named June Crane, who was a longtime employee of first Wright Field and then Wright-Patterson Air Force Base, who started well before Roswell, had all kinds of security clearances, was an extraordinarily decent, down-to-earth, very fine woman who James got to know toward the end of her life. And as she started to confide things to him, and James has a background as a police detective in the state of Washington. He is the new Washington State director for MUFON, and a great guy. She essentially said, if I were to tell my story, I would be arrested. And, you know, she had signed National Security Act papers and, in fact, would have been in violation of her government oaths. But as they did get to know each other better, she essentially said to him, having no close relatives who were consumed by the subject that James was, after I'm gone, you write my story. And I'll tell you what, James spent several years focusing in on putting together the brilliant, moving, by turns fascinating, anxiety-provoking, and so well-documented presentation. And he now also has a new book out about Juden Crane. So that talk will be called Roswell, Wright-Patterson Air Force Base, and Juden Crane. It will definitely be one of the high points of our conference. We go
I'm going to have to keep my eyes open for his book. I've had him on my program talking about Juden Crane, and it was absolutely fascinating.
The book came out, I think it just went into print 6 weeks or 2 months ago, and it's not a monster book. It's just, it takes everything that we saw in those presentations and gives it a permanent home on paper with a lot of the documents that he got after she passed away. Photographs, maps, everything you can imagine. And, you know, once he establishes the credibility and the ethics and the humanity of this woman and is able to back it up so brilliantly with all of the paperwork, I'll tell you what, it was like watching a play or something. It was an above and beyond experience, no question about it. The next one will be equally unique and something of a first. Even folks who are very involved in Roswell studies are not aware of some of what this talk will cover. The 509th atomic bomb wing, which we know, of course, was at the time of Roswell, the only atomic strike force in the world, bar none, was housed at the Roswell Army Airfield, as it was called at the time. And 12 years later, in 1959, was transferred out of New Mexico to Pease Air Force Base in beautiful New Hampshire. And when they went to New Hampshire, guess what went with them? Major UFO activity followed. Yeah. And a number of the players, a number of the individuals who were involved in Roswell, were also transferred over. And a very fine New Hampshire UFO investigator named Dean Merchant, who's become a good friend of mine over the past year or so, has put together one of the most fascinating new papers in ufology that I've been aware of for some years. It's essentially the 509th bomb wing's connection to the crash at Corona and the incident at Exeter. And nobody has done this work. Essentially, the part of the structure is to set up an atomic triangle, so to say, Pease Air Force Base, the nuclear naval shipyards, which are very close by in New Hampshire, and the Seabrook Nuclear Power Plant, all within 20 miles of each other in New Hampshire. And unfortunately, Dean will not be able to give the paper himself, so I will be stepping in. This is in no way my research or my material, and I will make that extremely clear to the audience, but I will be the one presenting it and showing the remarkable archival and other photographs, documents, and maps that Dean has put together. This will be a true first, and I'm encouraging Dean to put it in book form. Frankly, when he started to lay this out for me last year when I spoke in Exeter, I found myself almost like a kid just hanging on every word, you know what I mean. It was new information. And so we're very proud to be the first UFO conference ever, really, to present this.
When I was reading the little synopsis that you sent along with the list of speakers and, and their lecture titles, and I read that, one of the things that immediately came to mind was, oh, wow, Pease Air Force Base was, well, rather heavily involved with the Betty and Barney Hill case.
You better believe it. And it definitely draws some parallels between the Betty and Barney Hill case and Roswell. So I just can't tell you how excited I am to have the honor of being the one that's going to actually be presenting it. And then a scant 7 weeks later, be back in Exeter, speaking there very close to the sites of the incident at Exeter and the Betty and Barney Hill incident. We'll also have Stan Friedman there as well. Our next speaker is the extraordinary Karen Dolan, who has really carved out quite a career for herself, although not quite as well known as her husband. She's a remarkably focused researcher, has pioneered an area of studies earlier that has been very woefully neglected, the impact of the subject of UFOs from all points of view, whether it be parents' experiences, walking in on mom and dad when they're watching some kind of UFO documentary, abduction experiences, or UFOs in advertising and cartoons. But she's going to, the title of her talk is How the Roswell Incident Took Ufology to a New Level. And it will go into a great deal of early, early UFO evidence predating Roswell, and how everything seemed to have turned on that, including popular culture, advertising, etc. Rich Dolan, our resident historian, will be following up with Roswell in fact and history. And so he'll be taking kind of a two-track approach to Roswell to present the events as we've come to understand them, and also to superimpose them on post-war history. I can't wait. I'm embarrassed to say I don't have it on this unfinished outline here, but Alejandro Rojas, who now works for the fascinating multimedia UFO-related company Open Minds, which, by the way, has a very interesting and very high-tone magazine out now, and hopefully we will finally have another magazine to be a companion to UFO magazine in this country. It has been a long time coming. Alejandro left his position as media liaison at MUFON to join this company, and he's going to be speaking, and I forget the exact title, but it's going to be Roswell and the Media and Roswell and Popular Culture. So we have a heck of a two-day program right there, and I know it's going to be quite a symposium. It will be followed, of course, by a major panel discussion, and I will be presiding at that, and we'll make sure that the action moves along in a very lively manner.
Gosh, I wish we could go this year.
I know.
Think we're going to be able to.
Yeah, you guys have been kind of perennials at the last few. In fact, we've had some great times in Roswell.
Definitely. We were treated so wonderfully by the city of Roswell, and I can't thank them enough. Especially, you know, I think one of the highlights, though, was the passes to the Jefferson Starship and the party after.
What an amazing evening that was, wasn't it?
Yes, when it was wonderful to being able to sit there with you and Travis Walton, an individual I had wanted to talk to for how many years. And being in such a relaxed atmosphere and being able to share stories back and forth, and it was wonderful.
Yeah, for me too. I hope I'm never so deeply involved in this field that I get jaded, and being able to spend time with dear friends that I've gotten to know in the work, like you and David, and really well-known ones like Travis. We're also having Jesse Marcel, Jr., of course.
Awesome.
And he will be also speaking at the symposium. But there is something, given a lot of the lighthearted stuff that's geared toward kids and, you know, not super serious, to put it mildly, to have this gem of a scholarly conference set within this 4 days, and then get to hang out with these people in a really wonderful American city. Roswell has about 53,000 people, as I recall. Growing up in and around Manhattan, you know, the word city for me meant giant buildings and a billion people all over the place. and it took me a while as a kid to realize that the word meant other things as well. But, you know, it occurs to me, Dee, if a UFO or whatever hadn't come down that summer on the plains outside of Roswell, and maybe if there had never, if there never was a UFO phenomena, and we were perfectly placid, understanding that we were singular in the universe and it wasn't some controversial topic, this is still a really nice, interesting part of America. And I'm going to be there for a full 2 weeks, partly to get there early to help set up and be on the ground and be able to be as effective as I can in my responsibilities. But I'm staying for another week because if I have the honor of continuing in this job, part of my responsibility is to be as knowledgeable as possible about the area. So I'm going to try to get out every day and see more of the natural and cultural sites. I'm going to definitely on this trip try to get out to White Sands Proving Ground. And but it is a very special place. And again, all of the major events will be free. If you can get there, there's plenty of campgrounds. There's still hotel and motel and bed and breakfasts available. But if you're interested, you should move fast and visit the city's website, which is UFOConferenceRoswell.com, as opposed to Roswell UFO Conference. But that's UFO Conference Roswell. And if
it's UFO Festival Roswell.com. Is that the?
I'm sorry. Don't mind me. I am dyslexic. And yes, it is UFO Festival Roswell. Thank you so much on behalf.
Oh no,
of the
you owe David one because he keeps me well
informed. David, way to go! Thank you, brother. Well, the other thing is, if you really want to impress the people in town, do not say Roswell or Roswell. They will look at you with a smile, but they'll be somewhat contemptuous. It's Roswell, like Ros, and then like the stuff you get off a sheep. That is the authentic way to pronounce it, and it is ingrained in my cerebral cortex from having made an error, about 100 times when I first started working for them, and at one point in a conference call with the committee, a whole room of people screamed the proper pronunciation at me, and that was sort of a watermark. I have not slid back since.
I have to admit that I was corrected on the pronunciation by Frankie Rowe, of all people. And she was such a sweetheart. She was a child in 47.
Mm-hmm.
And she was the one that heard an MP, because at the time it was Army Air Corps, had told her father while smacking his own hand with his nightstick, saying, you know, if you don't keep your mouth shut, this is an awful big desert. We could take you out so far that your bones will never be found.
Oh, yeah. Yeah. I don't think anybody has covered that absolutely chilling aspect of this subject better than Don Schmidt and Tom Carey and Witness to Roswell. I understand they're working on a follow-up book to it right now.
Oh,
but,
good.
You know, for the popular imagination, the subject of a crashed machine from parts unknown is wild enough. And when you followed it up by saying that, you know, threats were made by Army Air Corps, as I understand it, it was mostly MPs who were chosen for their gravitas and their big size, who threatened the lives of many local people, including children. And one wants so much for this not to be true. I've actually heard people react angrily that it had to be an exaggeration. But when you hear the unbelievably large number of individuals and their accounts who have come forward with nothing to gain, certainly no money, no interest in writing a book or being on the Oprah show, and this goes back, at least 25 years to the remarkable documentary that the Fund for UFO Research did I think in the 80s, where they had documentary filmmakers in Roswell interviewing so many people who were alive then, and after how many dozen of these people looking right at you into the camera lens and telling you their account. And, you know, you're looking for any sign, we all do, it's a natural thing, of wavering or confabulation or what have you. At a certain point, you just start to get angry. But yes, Frankie's account is a good example. It's a good example, you bet.
Well, and then you take into account that the Army literally, I guess you could call it, arrested Mac Brazel.
Yeah.
And he was gone for a week. His son had to come in and take care of the ranch for that week.
Yeah.
That he was missing. I mean, it was, and after that, he wouldn't speak of it again.
Never did in his whole life to anybody that has ever come forward. Yes, he was held incommunicado, possibly in Hangar 84, although I don't know, for close to a week. And people who knew him said he was never quite the same. But he never, ever spoke about it again. And for anybody who is not familiar with the name, Mr. Brazel was the foreman of the ranch on which the debris field was discovered by him. And he was the first one to bring it to the attention of the rest of us, so to say. So he is a very, very special place in this work and in this story, no question about it.
Interesting question posted in the virtual auditorium.
Yeah.
From Skymon. He says, do you think Mac Brazel was paid off to be quiet? Mac Brazel had suddenly bought a brand new pickup, which is true. I mean,
yes.
The guy didn't own the ranch. He was just a foreman.
That's right.
He was just working the ranch for the owners. It was
yeah.
the Foster Ranch.
You know,
and
yeah.
ranch hands didn't make a heck of a lot of money back in 1947.
No, there's no question about that. And I'm glad that that question's been brought up. I started to really look into this about 3 years ago when I started to work as a consultant to the city. And had a chance to really get to know the area. And yes, it is true. He did have a new pickup truck, and he had enough money to start a small business not long afterwards. And you know what? I hope he was. I hope he was. There is one fictional treatment of this subject in a feature-length play that a very fine Broadway playwright named Marty Martin wrote called Top Secret Magic, which was staged in Roswell last year. It was a full two-act, about two-hour play, and part of the play was trying to imagine what did happen there. To the best of my knowledge, no investigators, researchers, or scholars on the subject have come up with an alternate place that the money for that business startup and that truck came from. So I'll tell you what, I hope he was. Let's remember that he came into town, and one of the first things he did was he went on the radio. And mm-hmm. he was the one who said, you know, yeah, you guys have there's a standing offer of whatever it was, $3,000 maybe, or $5,000. It was, of course, a promotion, and they didn't expect to have to pay off, that this radio station, and I dare say other radio stations around the country, were putting forward for proof of a real flying saucer. Remember, again, this is less than 2 weeks after the Kenneth Arnold sightings. And to the best of our knowledge, he didn't get the money from the radio station, and I hope he was paid off.
Personally, I do, too.
Yeah, it's little enough to ask for what he went through. My gosh.
Because, like you said, nobody knows for sure whether he was paid off to be quiet, you know, to
yeah.
keep his mouth shut. Which, and I agree with you, you know.
Yeah.
I sure hope the heck he did get paid
yeah.
off, you know.
Yeah.
I mean, you know, what are they going to do? You know, disappear the guy forever?
Yeah, I mean, well, of course they could have, although he was already high visibility in the area. And, I mean, I don't think they wanted to off anybody if they didn't have to. But the fact is, his life changed materially after the fact. And this is one of those interesting aspects of the bigger UFO story where, in good investigation, you try to triangulate and build evidence around your thesis. And where did that money come from? We know it wasn't there in his bank account, and then he had that money, and he had that truck, and he had that business, which I think was meat processing, beef processing. And he lived quite a long time after that. I think he lived at least until into the 1970s, and members of his family are still alive, and nobody has ever said anything, and maybe that's the way it should be. At least as far as his case goes. But a great question, and I hope that answer suffices.
I agree with you there. Gosh, it's just so many different scenarios could have happened. We have no idea.
Yeah.
Let's see. Gosh, another one that I would love to go and hear what their talk is. Is Ken Storch. I've met him once. I've had him on my program before.
Oh, cool.
And he, like you said, he brings the investigative techniques of a police officer to the table. And I think it's a great angle in investigating the subject.
Yeah. I heard Ken speak once. That was a couple of years ago, as I recall, at one of Ryan Wood's always terrific crash retrieval conferences, and was very impressed. So definitely looking at it again. And you know what, being that you brought him up, I'm just going to read the description of his talk, because for me, mentioning earlier Gary Hazeltine, the British police officer who is deeply involved in UFO research there and kind of expanding with his work here, I think it's very important, because there's a ridicule factor among law enforcement folks about this subject that's as more real than it is in many other businesses. So a serving police officer or sheriff or detective or legitimate investigative personnel, I think that's a bit above and beyond. I mean, you know, I have a BFA in painting and film history. What, are painters and film historians going to make fun of me? I can handle it, you know. But it's worth hearing this whole thing, especially if you've never heard anybody in law enforcement speak about this subject. And all the more so if you are in law enforcement and you'd like a credible introduction to this subject, please join us at the symposium in Roswell. Ken Storch has been in law enforcement for over 25 years. His interest in UFOs began in the 1960s while he worked for the USAF Strategic Air Command. Ken approaches the Roswell incident as he would any crime or suspicious event. His approach will be based on facts supplied by the government and agreed upon fully by both skeptics and believers that prove beyond a reasonable doubt that something really crashed in the desert. His approach convinced him that ET is here, and he was a skeptic himself until he took up a law enforcement approach to the incident. Ken will also talk about the constitutionality of the lies told by the government relative to this subject. So there's one for the books. Again, I'm just delighted that not only do we have Ken here, but that we have an entire 2 days of world-class presentations absolutely free from start to finish. And I'd also like to say that the previously mentioned Open Minds Company, and, you know, our buddy Alejandro has a radio show out of Phoenix that I believe is also called Open Minds. And they are really the main sponsor of the symposium. But Ken's presentation will be outstanding. And again, if you can get yourself to Roswell on the 4th of July weekend, we won't have the Jefferson Starship back, but we will have this amazing symposium, a lot of fun stuff, and although we don't have the funds to have a a group at that level of the game, and I think it was a great effort, but the idea of having a big concert like that to make money rather than have a good time, we learned a lesson on that. So we will have a number of performers and performances throughout those 4 days, but they'll probably be more weighed toward country western and more basic rock and roll, and all of those will be free as well, I think. Not positive on that.
Okay, David was attempting to send me a question, and he accidentally sent it to himself. Okay, here it
is. Nice, Dave.
Okay, this is from David. He says, Peter, having been at Roswell several times now, did you ever get to speak with any younger people who live in Roswell, and are any of them interested in the story about where they live?
Great question. I have, partly because I've been approached by some, and also in my role as MC of the conference, I've approached several younger people in the audience to find out their take on it, and I have to tell you, it's fairly split. There are those people, 20-somethings and teenagers, that just think it is amazingly and totally cool that maybe the most famous thing in the history of the world on a certain level happened in their backyard, and they have tremendous pride in it. I've spoken to other young men, specifically men, although could have been women as well, who are in the military right now and are more circumspect. Partly, and this is important to remember, partly because the Roswell events every year superimpose themselves on the most important holiday in the American calendar, the 4th of July. And as one would expect, in the Southwest, you have a good contingent of retirees, many of them with military backgrounds. You've got chapters of the American Legion and veterans of foreign wars, as one would expect and should be. And among them, there is a vague sense, and it extends right down to the younger people, that why do we have to have our 4th of July, we'd like a nice traditional one, caught up with all this silliness? And the only answer you can give these folks is it's just an accident of history. That's when it happened, right within a few days of that, the discovery was made, and, you know, we're sort of stuck with it. Most of the kids, teenagers and 20-somethings, wouldn't call them kids, that I've spoken with just think it's kind of cool, but have not gotten into any level of scholarship. You know, they love the fact that everybody all over the world knows the name Roswell, that there was this WB television program, you know, which was kind of goofy and had nothing to do with the story, called Roswell, that it's come up in different movies and was part of the plot point of the last Indiana Jones film. But what I don't see is a new generation getting deeply involved in UFO investigation and research, which concerns me a bit. I would like to see more young people turning their attention to this subject and, you know, not necessarily doing it professionally, but at least learning some of the rudiments and being open-minded about it. So, yeah, I think that there is something of a split in the community, but probably more than not, more of the young people in Roswell just think it's kind of cool and that it has put their small American city on the map, not only all over this country, but over almost all the rest of the world.
Ah, yes. There's another question here concerning this year's Roswell Festival. This is from Skymon, and he asks, is there a Roswell softball game this year?
I honestly don't know. The actual schedule of events, which I'm sorry to say I don't have in front of me, is huge. It is mind-boggling the amount of work and organization that has gone into putting this together, and the committees and the subcommittees and the sub-subcommittees of people, 99% of who are volunteers and are doing this because they take the subject seriously or they love their city or they want to be of service. I have a good friend who is a former director of MUFON for Pennsylvania, who is giving up that part of her summer, coming in at her own expense, and just helping out as a volunteer. I don't know. I don't know. I imagine there will be, though. They're having everything else in the universe, so that I would imagine they're having a softball game as well.
Here's another one from our virtual auditorium. This one's from Eternal Being, and he asks, have there been any other incidents around Roswell since 1947, or even before?
There have been more sightings, credible, multiple sightings, some of them documented with film, video, photography, other ones military witnessed, and there is a respectable amount of military documents to support that, to make it extremely clear that this is a relatively high incidence area for UFO sightings at the least. Yes, New Mexico probably has one of the highest historic incidents of credible, confirmed, and often multiple sightings of anomalous objects in the air since 1947. I have to tell you, Eternal Being, that I don't know that much about anomalous, what we'd call now UFO activity, predating the events of the summer of July 47. I honestly don't know. I'm sure that there are people like Dennis Balthaser or Don Burleson, important local scholars, who would have that information, or very likely the International UFO Museum and Research Center in Roswell, which also will be having its own independent program of events. But make no mistake about it, this is an area that continues to have very credible and sometimes very extraordinary UFO sightings. I have had a number of local people, a few of them who have become good friends over the past 4 years, confide to me some absolute knockouts. One in particular that I wish I could share, but I was asked not to, so I won't. But it was from a local law enforcement personnel, and it was one of the most jaw-dropping sighting events I've ever had described from to me by somebody who was, as far as I'm concerned, 110% credible. But yes, the long answer, the short answer is yes, definitely.
I can add a little bit to that. Edward Ruppelt, during his tenure as head of Blue Book, knew about a research project that was being done by Los Alamos in conjunction with Oak Ridge, where they were using their radiation detectors to track UFOs.
Boy.
And that was an interesting incident.
And this, again, is one of those areas where I'm pleased to say there are quite a handful of documents from the 40s and the 50s, at the least, that name Roswell, among other locations in New Mexico, reporting in via the Air Force or the Army, very, very credible military sightings that are not military in nature, that the witnesses or the COs at the bases were aware of.
Here's another question from our virtual auditorium. This, again, is from David. He asks, has anyone compared the level of UFO activity in the area when the 509th was in Roswell to the activity in New Hampshire after the 509th moved to New Hampshire?
Good question, David. I do not know. I do not know. That is a question I will be glad to ask some of the local scholars on the ground there in July, and also to find out if we can get some information from Dean Merchant. who lives near Exeter in New Hampshire to find out if he has statistics as well as, you know, incident reports. Again, I'll be giving that paper, but he hasn't quite completed it yet, so I can't refer to it here.
Understandable. Mm-hmm. Understandable. Mm-hmm. You know, and here was one that David had wanted me to ask you quite a while ago. Oh, gosh, now I can find where I put it. There it is. And this is concerning Rendlesham Forest.
Mm.
He says, Peter, you should know as well as anyone the answer to this question. Has Charles Halt changed his story as time went on, or did he just leave things out early on that he eventually talked about later?
Hmm. I know that he is definitely, and I say this in no way to put down or demean Mr. Halt, but yeah, he withheld quite a number of things that he is now on record with, and appropriately. He is a serving military office and a deputy base commander, and it would have been completely inappropriate to say certain things, and there are probably things that he will never speak about because he's not able to, having honorably retired and having taken the national security oath. Whether or not he's changed his story markedly, I would have to hesitate before I answered that and really go over, quite literally, the comments that he has made since leaving the service, and that dates back quite a few years already now, compared to what, you know, he has added since. And I am very slow to accuse anybody of anything without having first completely gone over the record. It's not fair and it's not right. And it's a terrific question, and I'm not trying to evade it. I simply, it would not be right in any sense for me to just say, yeah, you know, he's changed his story, and then not be able to give you an example of where he's changed it. Also, I'm particularly sensitive to this issue because for years, my co-author and good friend Larry Warren, who not only was an eyewitness, but the whistleblower, the person that broke this whole story open, has been accused for years of changing his story when, in fact, he did not give the entire story, and especially the part about the other intelligences. He knew what was going to happen. I mean, he was left to hang out to dry for a number of years. And even now, the other individuals who have come forward on this have done so in a very circumspect way, and two of them still anonymously. I know who they are, and certainly other people who follow the story very carefully do. But it has been very frustrating and occasionally angering to me to hear Larry basically called a liar because he did not tell the whole story. He did it with me when he first started to bring me into this in 1987. And frankly, had he told me everything that he knew or that he had experienced at that time, I don't think I would have gotten involved. I'm not uncourageous in certain situations, but that would have been too much too soon, and I wouldn't put Mr. Halt in that spot either. But it is a good question, and I might just start to go over his published remarks and broadcast remarks and see if in fact there is anything to that. But without question, he has added to his account, and I'm very pleased he has. He has even, over the past year, for the very first time, criticized certain higher-up officers, and two of them by name. One of them, Malcolm Ziegler, and the other, Gordon Williams. And frankly, I thought that was a breath of fresh air. I had accused him, in public and private on a number of occasions, of not watching out for his men properly and not being Air Force. I did not know that, in fact, maybe he was doing the best that he could, but his ability was limited by higher-ups. And so I was very pleased that he broke protocol and expressed his own anger and frustration that higher-ups perhaps should have done more to protect or respect the individuals who had been involved as witnesses and were so traumatized by it.
I agree with that. And unfortunately, we are just about out of time. If you'd like to give the website for the Roswell Symposium.
Not only would I, but I'll give it correctly, too. That's www.ufofestivalroswell.com.
Fantastic. And gosh, I wish that David and I could go there this year, but it's just not in the budget.
I think you have to start investing in your future, which means buy some lottery tickets.
Oh, gosh, we do, but we never win anything.
Yeah.
Even the scratch-off.
Oh, darn.
See when I do. Oh, gosh. Unfortunately, we are all out of time. I want to thank you again, Peter, for joining us as usual. I had a blast talking
to you. It's my pleasure, Dee. Always wonderful doing your show. And to the man behind the scenes, thank you for making it run as smoothly as you do, David.
And I'd like to thank everyone for joining us tonight, and all those who joined us here in the Pal Talk Auditorium. Great bunch of people tonight. Appreciate it. Stay tuned for Voice of the People, hosted by November Hansen. Her guest tonight will be Dr. Bob, and I believe it's pronounced Curran, or Curran. Please join us again next Saturday for Eye to the Sky, the UFO synopsis. Until then, keep an eye to the sky. Good night, everyone. Uh-huh.